Labor Radio has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by SEIU Local 503, OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, a weekly program about working people, the labor movement, and organizing on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Don McIntosh. On the first part of tonight's show, we're joined in the studio by Scott Nova, the executive director of the Workers' Rights Consortium, an anti-sweatshop group that works to certify that campuses across America are sweatshop-free. He'll be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. for those of you who've not made your plans for the evening at Portland State University's Multicultural Center. In part two of the show, we'll be joined by Jeff Creeley, who is an employee of the National Center for Responsible Philanthropy, an organization which just has produced a report criticizing Walmart's record of stingy corporate giving, not giving back to community, and giving in ways that enhance their self-interest primarily. That's in the second part of tonight's show. And in the third part, we'll be joined by a rotating cast of guests to talk about today's Oregon AFL-CIO convention. Oregon AFL-CIO President Tim Nesbitt announced his resignation last week, and as faithful listeners may know, the labor movement has been convulsed by some serious disaffiliations. We'll talk about that and more in the second half of our program tonight. Now I would like to welcome to Labor Radio Scott Nova. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Don.
Let's talk just the first a bit. For those who are not familiar with Workers' Rights Consortium, tell us how you were founded and what you guys do.
Well, the Workers' Rights Consortium, or WRC, was created 5 years ago, really as a product of the national student movement. Just a bit of background, universities across the country have business deals with companies like Nike and Adidas, whereby the universities allow Nike and Adidas to make and sell clothing with university names. In exchange, the universities get a cut of the sales of this clothing, which is lucrative for the companies and lucrative for the university. There's about $3 billion worth of this university logo apparel sold every year in the United States. Beginning in the late 1990s, students became concerned about the conditions, working conditions, under which this apparel was being produced. Of course, companies like Nike no longer make clothing. They buy it from contract factories, mostly in the third world. And a lot
Actually,
of these
I just want to jump in say that I happen to know a person in Portland because, you know, Nike being mm-hmm. is the capital. It turns out that Nike doesn't even do its own outsourcing. It's actually outsourced its outsourcing, if you can believe that.
Sure. Well, this is actually the nature of the clothing industry. Clothing companies, which is to say companies that sell clothing, are no longer the companies that make clothing. They have contractors spread across the world. Those contractors have subcontractors and so on. The result is that the actual conditions under which the clothing gets produced are further and further distanced from the consumer. Students were concerned, and rightly so, about the fact that a lot of this clothing is made under conditions that can only fairly be called sweatshop conditions, and they asked universities to adopt codes of conduct, which essentially require that Nike and all these other clothing brands guarantee that the rights of workers are respected in any factory anywhere in the world that makes clothing that ends up with the name and logo of a university on it. Our job at the Worker Rights Consortium is to enforce those codes of conduct by investigating factory conditions, usually in response to complaints from workers or worker organizations, and where we find violations, which is very common, pressuring the factory through the universities to eliminate the violations and respect the rights of workers, and particularly the right to organize and bargain collectively.
Right, so, I mean, at the time, at least 5 years ago, I mean, you know, the companies, Nike, Adidas, and so forth, they were unwilling to take responsibility for the conditions of the workers in the factories that produced their clothing. But the students, you know, they wanted someone to hold accountable. They went to their university administrations and said, you know, we need you to assure that these are not made in sweatshops. Of course, you know, some listeners may know that, as I recall, the first university to agree to that was actually University of Oregon. Now, interestingly enough, they then recanted a phone call from Phil Knight and a promise to withdraw a substantial donation. Changed their point of view. Can you tell us about that story? That was before you got to the group, right?
Well, there is what you might call a rich history there. It was before I got to the group. Just on your first point, which is a very important one, it is true, 10 years ago, it was the official position of the major clothing brands, including Nike, that they had no responsibility for the conditions in these overseas contract factories, that these weren't their factories, they didn't own them, and they essentially had a hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil attitude toward it. As a result of pressure from students and other activists, there's been a sea change in the official posture of the industry. Now it's virtually impossible to find a major clothing company that doesn't openly acknowledge that it's responsible for those conditions.
And there's been a proliferation of these corporate codes of conduct,
sure,
which I want to ask you about in a minute.
Okay. In terms of the University of Oregon situation, yes, it's true. U of O was one of the first universities to join the WRC in response to student activism. Phil Knight, of course, is one of the university's most famous alumnus, and he threatened to withdraw a promised $30 million contribution. A couple of years after that, the university withdrew. Now, of course, the university's official position was that it had nothing to do with Phil Knight, that they were withdrew because of a ruling by a government board that having a code of conduct was illegal under Oregon law because it represented conditioning a business relationship, a contract, on something other than performance of the contract. In other words, that it was akin to nepotism. As a result, there is no public university in Oregon that is part of the WRC or part of the more corporate-friendly Fair Labor Association, or that even has a code of conduct that applies to its logo apparel. In essence, public universities in Oregon have withdrawn from the whole process.
A little shocking because, in fact, Oregon is in a fairly progressive place, and certainly a lot of students, including undoubtedly students that will be coming to your conference tonight. Again, 7 o'clock, you'll be speaking at PSU's Portland State University's Multicultural Center, which is, as I recall, on 1850 Southwest Broadway, having been a student there myself. So University of Oregon sort of blazed the trail, shall we say, and then pulled out. But how many universities do you currently have?
There are just shy of 150 universities in the WRC, including many of the major state universities and the key sports school.
And combined, Washington,
yeah, University of Washington, for example, Evergreen. And combined, it's a lot of market clout. These are big players in the industry. Companies like Nike care a great deal about university logo apparel because associating themselves with university sports is part of their overall image-building strategy. So the universities have influence beyond the economics, and they've in a position to use it to have a very significant impact on working conditions overseas.
So, which speaking of which, then, so do you personally or do your staff then visit these factories, in Bangladesh, China?
We do, indeed. We have staff both in the U.S. and overseas whose job is to enter apparel factories and look at conditions, and also to interview workers. Now, of course, most of the worker interviews we do are done off-site, where the workers are much more comfortable speaking candidly than they would be if they were in their employer's conference room. But, yeah, we're inside the factories, outside the factories, very hands-on in the process of investigating working conditions and finding out what's really going on in these facilities.
In case you just joined us, we're talking with Scott Nova, the executive director of the Workers' Rights Consortium. He'll be speaking tonight again, 7 p.m. at PSU's Multicultural Center. So you yourself have visited the factories.
I have indeed.
Anything you want to share about that? I don't imagine they're like American factories.
Well, one of the interesting things is if you walk into the average apparel factory in a developing country, it doesn't immediately strike you as a sweatshop, partly because land is relatively cheap and there's a lot of space, so they're spread out, they're open. But as you talk to workers and begin to find out what goes on a daily basis in these factories, as you look at the wages that workers are being paid, as you look at the manner in which supervisors treat workers, you begin to realize that these are some of the worst conditions that you will see in the industrial world. Typical management practices involving verbal and sometimes physical abuse of workers as part of a conscious strategy to force workers to sew as fast as it's humanly possible to sew. Wages so low that in many cases workers do not even earn enough to feed their families, much less purchase other necessities of life. So quite horrible conditions, and still the case, despite all of the sweatshop debate over the last 10 years, still the case that conditions have not improved substantially.
But I would assume that in the factories like that that you may have visited, that those are not being certified, that you know, University of Washington logo is not going on clothing made by, like that?
Well, the university logos are going on this clothing. I mean, it's important to understand that the sweatshop problem is endemic in the apparel industry. Sweatshop conditions are the norm in apparel production, and even if they wanted to do so, neither the brands nor the universities can fix that overnight. So the question is not whether on a given day there's any worker rights violation. The question is, have universities put in place a program that is over time going to fix the problem and ensure that university logo goods are not made in sweatshops? And universities have taken, in response to student activism, some very positive steps forward. But what we've learned over the last several years is that there are some steps that have not yet been taken that are vital that universities are going to have to take if this work is really going to get done properly. And I can tell you a little bit about that.
Yeah, please do, because what I'm hearing is that you can't be assured as a consumer maybe of a university product like this that it isn't being made in a sweatshop. Maybe they're just having a conversation about it. I mean,
no, you can't be sure about a university product or, for that matter, any clothing product that you buy in a store in the United States. Corporations, in response to pressure from activists, as you noted earlier, have themselves adopted codes of conduct, acknowledged responsibility, and said they're going to investigate, audit the factories, and make sure things are okay. And they have, in fact, started to ask their suppliers to improve labor conditions, with some very modest gains as a result. But what the brands have not been willing to do is change the way that they relate to these supplier factories overseas. And if they don't change the way they relate to these factories, there will never be fundamental lasting change in the industry. And here's the problem. The brands, Nike, Reebok, Adidas, Walmart, Gap, and hundreds of others, are in an enormously powerful position relative to these overseas factories who are desperate for orders, desperate for business. The brands jump from factory to factory, month by month, year by year, in a constant search for lower prices. As a result, factories are desperate for business, willing essentially to meet any price the customers name, and the customers use this leverage to drive prices constantly down. Factories, in order to survive, have to find a way to meet prices that do not reflect the true costs of producing under decent working conditions, and historically the way they've done it is to ignore worker rights. The way that they meet the price that the brands demand is to ignore their worker rights obligations. So while the brands are now saying to the factories, we want you to improve labor conditions, the reality is that improving labor conditions costs money, but the brands will not raise their prices to make it possible for the factories to improve labor conditions. So what you get is a great deal of fakery and deception, factories pretending to comply with labor standards without really complying, and brands turning a blind eye to the process. And until and unless the brands are willing to pay a fair price for these products, a price that reflects the true cost of producing under decent working conditions at decent wages, we're not going to see real change in the industry. And students are now demanding that universities require these brands, including Nike and Adidas and the other major sports apparel companies, to pay a price to these factories sufficient to enable the factories to truly comply with international labor standards.
Well, I guess I'm a little bit sorry to hear that the more progress hasn't been made in the sense of, you know, corporations really coming around, because honestly, that was my suspicion about these corporate codes of conduct. You know, a lot of nice language and maybe, you know, not sure so much about the follow through. I was, there was a conference actually at the University of Oregon, put on by the Labor Education and Research Center, last year, about sweatshops, and the movement against it. And there was a representative, bravely enough, from the Gap Corporation there. And of course she was the target of quite a few heated questions, including for myself, a reporter. I really didn't get the sense, I really was not convinced that the company was, you know, it sounded nice, but it's sort of like every detail I asked there, it was sort of an elusive target that they actually committed to any kind of standard, in fact.
Sure. Well, neither the Gap nor any of these other brands have truly committed to making the changes that are necessary to achieve decent working conditions. And that means paying decent prices to the factories. It means not jumping from factory to factory every season and kicking thousands of workers out of their jobs. The brands continue to approach this primarily as a public relations problem. They have a problem. Consumers don't trust that clothes are made under good working conditions. They have two options. They can either fix the problem or pretend to fix the problem. They've chosen the less expensive route, which is to pretend to fix the problem. They've had some success at convincing consumers they're doing it. But real change is not happening, and there has to be more to be that's done if we're really going to see decent working conditions in these facilities.
And I would think that what you do then, part of, you know, is really casting a spotlight on, you know, to the extent to which they're doing what they say they're going to do.
We try to bring the truth to the universities about what's really going on in these factories and what is going to be necessary if real change and lasting change is going to happen.
You know, we just have maybe a minute left, sure, left in this segment, but I wanted to ask, you know, your group, the Workers' Rights Consortium, is a product of a student movement. you know, the media, of course, is a very fickle mistress, and you hear about something, and then you don't hear about it for a while. Is the student movement still active around sweatshop issues? Because, you know, of course, I haven't necessarily had that personal experience recently of hearing a lot about it.
No, it is indeed. Students just 3 weeks ago on 42 major campuses around the country launched the new campaign I just mentioned to demand that the clothing companies pay a price to the factories decent enough for the factories to actually respect worker rights and comply with labor standards. And there are active campaigns on these 42 campuses. It's spreading to other campuses. The movement is as active, as aggressive, as energized now as it's been any time in the last 10 years.
Glad to hear it. And just because the media doesn't report it doesn't mean it's not happening.
Indeed.
It's been a pleasure, Scott Nova, to have you. Again, I want to encourage the listeners, of course, listen to Labor Radio on the way, on your bike or in your car, on the way down to PSU. Come hear Scott Nova speak. Tell us anything about the conference itself tonight.
It's going to be a discussion about these very same issues, about what's really going on in clothing factories around the world, and about what universities and also cities and state governments that buy clothing can do to improve conditions and ensure that worker rights are respected.
And just to add to the allure, you're going to be on a panel apparently with a sweatshop worker from the Philippines.
Indeed, Chia Bad, who is a worker in the Marianas Islands.
And also someone from the group Global Exchange, wonderful organization based in San Francisco. Scott, thanks for coming down.
Thank you, Dan. My pleasure.
We've been talking with Scott Nova, the executive director of the Workers' Rights Consortium. Again, hear him at 7 p.m. tonight, PSU Multicultural Center. I understand now we have holding on the line to join us with Labor Radio, Jeff Creeley. Jeff, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Don. Hi.
Jeff, thanks for your patience. Jeff joins us apparently burning the 9 o'clock oil on the East Coast from his office at the National Center for Responsive Philanthropy.
My pleasure.
Can you tell us just a word or two about your organization and what you guys do? And by the way, for those who didn't hear the introduction to the program, we're going to be talking about Walmart and its, I guess, rather poor record of giving. But what about your group?
We're a foundation watchdog organization based here in D.C., and we're basically keeping a look at corporate philanthropy and private foundations as well, trying to get a handle on who they're giving their money to, what might be some political motivations, conflicts of interest, that sort of thing. And we advocate for greater transparency in these organizations, you know, under the perspective that they all operate with very significant tax breaks. So, you know, everyone in the country, in a sense, is footing part of the bill for their operation. So we all have a say in what they do in their programs and where they give their money.
And, of course, I imagine they benefit from a variety of tax breaks. But when they give, like, to some worthy cause, do they get a tax break for that as well?
They don't get break for that. They get a tax break on all their investment income that they're generating. The original donors get tax breaks when they set up foundations. Corporations get tax breaks when they give gifts to charity. So there's a pretty wide range of tax break options that they could access from, you know, when they first start up and throughout their operation.
So I guess earlier this month, am I right, you guys released a report, The Waltons and Walmart, Self-Interested Philanthropy.
Yes.
What drew you to look into Walmart's giving?
Well, we noticed that they really rocketed in the last couple of years from having a rather modest corporate giving program to being the leading corporate grant maker in the country. And we thought it was, you know, a pretty interesting development considering the different you know, movements against Walmart that are going on right now and the bad PR that the company has been receiving, that suddenly they were, you know, really ratcheting up their philanthropy and touting this philanthropy through a whole series of commercials across the country.
Well, I think that they actually had even a little bit of a PR black eye about their giving history. I mean, they were just, you know, I remember reading something about how chintzy they were. They'd give, like, you know, $50 to the local softball team and then spend $1,000 publicizing it, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's still their model. It's just on a much greater scale.
And now they give, like, $500,000, but they spend, you know, $10 million publicizing it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they gave away $170 million in 2004, primarily through these very small $50, $100, $200 grants that they then go on TV and, you know, brag about and act like they're making such a huge contribution to the community.
So tell us about the report then. How did you compile the data? It's an enormous corporation. Did they cooperate with you?
Not really, no. They haven't been very happy at all with the report since it's been out and it's been getting some press coverage. And they were actually trying to spread some rumors that we were being funded by Target to do this report and to tarnish their image, which really isn't true at all. So that was their counteroffensive. But
right,
there
was something Target had given to some organization that was connected with you like years before or something like that. Is that the secret?
Yeah, it was a previous foundation before they were Target stores entirely, and they had given during the 1990s before any of the current staff had started working here. But
they seized on that to discredit your work. What was it that they were trying to discredit? What's your essential point of your report?
The point of the report, we were really just trying to get at the connection between this bad PR that they were having in the press and their newfound interest in philanthropy, and really trying to debunk the myth that they were really, you know, trying to be good corporate citizens and good parts of the community. And we also wanted to tie in the Walton family itself, because they have their own separate private family foundation where they're doing a lot of funding for, you know, rather conservative advocacy around tax policy, you know, free market, environmental regulations, that sort of thing, things that would really benefit the company's bottom line.
You know, I don't know any of them myself, but like three or four of them are on the world's like list of top billionaires, am I right?
Yeah, and collectively they're the world's richest family right now. They've surpassed everyone else according to most accounts right now.
So the interesting thing is whether they're going to turn around in some fashion and become maybe like the Carnegies or, you know, the MacArthurs or, you know, these other you know, sort of dynasties that come out and decide to you know, make a name for themselves by philanthropy as well as by being, you know, rubber barons and exploiting workers and consumers and all that. So so far they're they haven't made a name for themselves in the giving world.
Not to that extent. I mean, they are, you know, a substantial foundation. They're giving away, you know, millions and millions of dollars every year, but they haven't, you know, really kicked in a lot of their own personal wealth to endow a foundation at this point, like the Ford, you know, or Carnegie Front foundations did. And they're also, you know, pretty aggressively lobbying, you know, to permanently repeal the estate tax, for example, something that would really allow them to preserve their wealth and presumably hold on to it rather than, you know, give it away to philanthropy even.
So they are, Walmart, is it the number one corporation at this point in the United States?
Yes.
And yet they're the 51st largest corporate giver. Am I mixing that up?
They're based on assets of the corporate foundation. They're 51st, but they're actually number one in terms of the dollar amount given.
Oh, they are. Okay.
Yeah, they've gone from about $60 million around 2000, and like I said, they're up to $170 million in 2004.
So did you ever feel like maybe you were being a little bit unfair? I mean, they hadn't learned about tithing, they hadn't learned about the value of giving and so forth, but all of a sudden they really ramp it up, and then that's when you release your report?
you know, it's an interesting perspective, but we really think that, you know, when they're giving things away, giving money away and touting it to such an extent to really, you know, encourage people to shop at their stores, that's really not what philanthropy is intended for. That's not the reason why they get tax breaks for doing it. And we felt it was our responsibility, based on what our organization does, to really call attention to this and make the general public really think about what Walmart philanthropy really means.
Now, I'm going to be in this next question maybe a little bit of a devil's advocate. Of course, you know, these days the devil doesn't need that many advocates, but what the heck. It's you know, in a lot of ways, I really see Walmart as sort of like the corporate best practices. I mean, these are the most modern corporate techniques for squeezing every dime out of everybody, you know, worker, consumer, et cetera. They have a particular model of discounting and so forth, and they've made billions at it. But the idea that they're not maybe their motives aren't pure when they give, I mean, aren't all corporations more or less like that? I mean, maybe you're actually in a position to know. Maybe are there corporate CEOs who give and don't want credit, or there's, you know, they're giving anonymously, or maybe they don't trumpet it?
Well, part of the problem is that there aren't really good corporate disclosure rules when it comes to philanthropy in this country. Unless the corporation is actually giving through a foundation, they don't have to disclose their charitable contributions. So we don't have a full picture of corporate philanthropy to begin with. But we find, you know, 9 times out of 10 that it's indeed a very self-interested style of philanthropy when it's coming from a corporation. And we, you know, call account all corporations when it comes to this sort of thing. We're not just picking on Walmart. We have a pretty long record at calling attention to this issue and calling for more disclosure on corporate philanthropy as well.
So I take it that the National Center on Responsive Philanthropy is not popular in the corporate donor world.
No, we really don't get too many corporate gifts ourselves. So, you know, and we also have a tough time with nonprofit allies, even very progressive allies, who, you know, are getting significant money from corporations, and they won't join us in pushing for the disclosure.
Because may not want to bite the hand that feeds them, even if it's just crumbs they're being fed.
Exactly, exactly.
So, you know, the response from Walmart was to discredit you. Do you think they're going to change their behavior as a result of the report?
You know, that's really hard to say. They've got so many different issues on their plate. I doubt that, you know, really worrying too much about their philanthropy is high on their list right now. It doesn't require any legal action right now. But, you know, for our organization, it's something we're going to, you know, keep pushing and keep monitoring and keep calling connections out when we see them and, you know, really try to, you know, bring light to their motivations behind their philanthropy.
In case you've joined us,
giving at this level.
In case you've joined us late, you're listening to Labor Radio, and we're talking with Jeff Creeley from the National Center for Responsive Philanthropy about a report they've just produced about Walmart and its record of giving. You know, just a few minutes left in our segment here, Jeff, but I wonder, you know, does... In the case, I'm very curious to know, how do you distinguish between, you know, self-interested giving versus disinterested giving? I mean, like, what are the signs? Is it who they give to? How much? How much they spend publicizing it? Or?
Yeah, definitely when you can get a sense of how much they're spending publicizing their philanthropy, and for some corporations, they spend much more publicizing it than they actually spend giving away. You know, that's something we really look at. That's a clear indicator for us. And you know, when it's very much tied into the markets that the company is operating in, that's another big sign that, you know, if they're just restricting it to where their customers might be, for example, where they can advertise it, that's another big sign.
I don't know how long your group has been around or whether you may have been behind this, but I remember reading a number of years ago, there was this great ad campaign, I think it might have been Chevron, and they had gone and they'd saved some foxes somewhere. They'd done some deed, maybe they were required to by the law, I don't know. But anyway, they saved some foxes, nice little foxes, and then they installed a camera to see, you know, how the foxes were doing and used that to make a television commercial to show how good they were for the environment. And I just thought at the time, I mean, wow, that's pretty obvious. I mean, that was an expensive set of cameras and so forth for these little foxes. I mean, but to me, it was just very amusing and very obvious that they were more interested in the publicity for their good deed, you know, look, I'm giving a penny to the poor, you know, than in actually helping the foxes, maybe.
Exactly. And, you know, it's something that we see more often than not. But again, you know, Walmart really caught our eye because they've been increasing their giving so much and they are leading the pack right now. So we thought they definitely deserve some scrutiny there.
Well, anything more you might add, you know, for our listeners who might be interested in finding out more? I know that on your site, I think you have to pay money for the report. Is there some basic sort of synopsis of it that people can get in touch with?
Yeah, definitely. You know, people should really, you know, keep in mind the connections between the family's money and the corporation's money, that the Waltons are, you know, definitely have a vested economic interest in their company, all obviously. And they're going to use, you know, not just, you know, exploiting labor and the environment to increase their profit margins. They're going to use philanthropy as well and really tying the connections and looking at the full scope of their PR philanthropy campaigns is really important to understanding this company.
And I guess, you know, one sort of obvious question to me is, who funds you guys then?
We're funded primarily by private foundations, which gets us into some trouble because they often don't like what we're saying about them, but we keep pushing on and take their criticism as it comes. And, you know, it's not easy to fundraise, you know, to basically bite the hand that feeds you. But that's what we do, and we're happy to do it.
And it's very, very brave of you. I want to thank you for joining us tonight. What's the website where people can get more information about this, Jeff?
It's www.ncrp.org.
NCRP, of course, standing for the National Center on Responsive Philanthropy. Jeff Creeley, it's been a pleasure to have you on Labor Radio.
Great. Thank you, Don.
Thanks for joining us. We now move in just a moment to our third and final segment, which will take up the last half of the hour. We're going to, in just a moment, be talking with Mary Orr, who is a delegate from the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees to today's Oregon AFL-CIO convention. A lot of momentous things going on. We'll be joined not only by Mary, but I have a short list. We think we'll have Madeline Elder, a former host of this show. Also, Elsie Hansen, maybe known to many KBOO listeners for her musical programming. Of course, happens to be a union official with the letter carriers. She'll be joining us. Also, Joe Keir and maybe even have a surprise visit from someone else. So that's just ahead, but I want to say, have a few words said about the organizations that make this show possible.
Labor Radio has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from AFSCME, Local 3336, representing the employees of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality by advocating for working conditions, pay and benefits, supporting political activity that promotes pro-environment and pro-labor positions, strengthening labor coalitions, and actively organizing members. More information at AFSCME3336.org. And by AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.w.
Okay, and we're back listening to Labor Radio, a weekly program about the working people, organizing unions. That's what this is about. Again, my name is Don McIntosh. I'm your host. You know, by day, I'm a reporter for the Northwest Labor Press newspaper, which is a union paper. Comes out twice a month. Check it out online at www.nwlaborpress.org for news about the labor movement, which is a movement for all working people, in fact. I'm joined in the studio now by Mary Orr. Mary, welcome to Labor Radio.
And it's thanks, Don. It's a real pleasure to be back here. I was the volunteer coordinator for KABU back in 1977-78 and actually pounded nails to build this studio here. So it's quite fun being on this side of the microphone.
And I knew that about you, and I'm just glad to have you back as a homecoming. Maybe you'll come on as a frequent guest. You know, Mary, for those who don't have the pleasure of knowing her, is a union activist, a real, dare I say, militant for workers' rights within the union movement in a lot of ways. You're active at your local, which is the local 88 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, that supports this program, in fact. And you've been active in that local for years, and until very recently were the editor of its very, very good newsletter. So thanks again for joining us. I don't usually dwell on praise, but I just think in this point, you know, you got to give credit where it's due, fellow journalist. So, Mary, you were today a delegate at the Oregon AFL-CIO convention. It began today, basically. It ends tomorrow. Rather momentous convention, wouldn't you say?
I would. By the way, is there anything we can do about the echo in these headphones?
I don't know that, but it's sort of enjoyable depending on your state of mind.
Okay, well, I'll concentrate on the fun part of it then.
Or you can take the headphones off, actually.
Let's do that. That's better. There you go.
And I should jump in, too. Not everyone knows what the AFL-CIO is. It is the federation to which, until recently, almost all unions belonged. Now, two-thirds of the unions in America basically belong to this federation, and a number of them have left. We'll talk about that. But so that group has Oregon and Portland bodies as well as national. So the Oregon affiliate of the AFL-CIO had its convention, which takes place every 2 years. It had its convention today and tomorrow. So,
that's right. That's right. The state AFL-CIO. We had a fantastic lineup of speakers today. I'll talk about that in a minute. And also talk about the mood a little bit. You just alluded to the split that happened, and it really was a split with about 40% of the unions nationwide that belong, leaving over issues of strategy, mainly. And it, at first, I think everyone was really hurt by this, and yet it seems if you were in that room today, you would not sense that, because what it felt like there was optimism. How can we work together even though some of the unions have left? How are there ways that we can continue working together? Everyone recognizes what a united union movement does to improve conditions for all workers. And that's at the ballot, with the ballot measures, at the ballot box, in the legislature, everywhere, covering more topics than just your typical bread and butter issues. And I think everyone knows that, and the best efforts are being put forward to continue that work. And so
I think that's particularly important, actually, with your union, AFSCME, because AFSCME has, I mean, not to air just maybe a little bit of dirty laundry, but it's somewhat of a rivalry to some extent with SEIU, which is the other major public employees union, you know, discounting the teachers union. But, I mean, you guys have had, you know, some competitive rivalry over the years, and so I think the potential for this to have sort of a battle between two big unions was very great, and so far it seems like you guys have averted it, and one way or another you're committing to work together.
I believe that that's true.
Even though they've left the Federation.
Right, I believe that's true. You know, time will tell. But a number of the speakers today talked about this, including those who aren't specifically in the labor movement, like Peter DeFazio, for example, talked about this. And he said, you know, the split is really not about the objectives. We share the objectives. But more it's a split about that comes out of the frustrations about what's happening here in this country, with 70% of people saying, you know, the country's going in the wrong direction. There's just different tactics to get there. And in the past, you know, the AFL has split and come back together in very historic moments, and I think it's made it stronger. And so we've got to look at it that way and say it's going to make us stronger. We're in the news. A lot of politicians are sitting there really licking their chops saying, oh, good, the labor movement is falling apart. But if you were in that room today, you would know it was not falling apart. And rather than falling apart, I would say that everyone was looking toward what they're at a point where they're saying, this can't get much worse, or maybe it can. And if it does, we are really sunk. People are pushed against the wall now to say, what are we going to do?
Mary, we're gonna come back to some more of your observations and your eyewitness report today about the convention. But I understand we have Elsie Hansen holding on the line. Elsie, are you with us?
I am here.
Thanks for joining us. We're pulling you out of a committee meeting, so we'll try and use your time well. What was your reaction today to, you know, the feeling about Tim Nesbitt's resignation? He's been, you know, it seems for so many, such a leader and a unifying force in the Oregon AFL-CIO, and as, you know, some of the listeners may know, last week he announced that he's resigning as president.
Well, I like Tim Nesbitt. I think that he's made quantum leaps for the Oregon AFL-CIO since he took office 6 years ago. I think he's great. I'm going to miss him. I've told him a lot of jokes about if I see his...
Okay. Elsie, are you with us? A bad connection. We'll try and reestablish that in a second. I really wanted to hear what she had to say, so we'll work that out. Unfortunately, we have Mary still with her. Can you finish her sentence? Maybe, maybe not. But, you know, maybe your reaction too, Mary, to Tim's departure. I mean, locally we're being hit by both the split, potentially, of these unions and then also the leadership itself departing.
Well, Tim, I think, he's raised the standards. He's changed the way we look at things. He's changed it so that we look to the big picture and to get on the offensive rather than being on the defensive when it comes to ballot measures. And when I say the big picture, it's looking to put that spin on the labor movement in a really positive way. And he has set a stage so that people who follow him are going, I believe, going to continue that and also continue working even when there's disagreements, be able to understand that if we don't all work together, we're not going to get anywhere. Tim talked about there's help and hope in these hard times.
Elsie, I hear we've got you back.
Can you hear me now?
We can. That's the famous slogan for cell phones, which I understand we're using right now. Elsie, by the way, I didn't properly identify when she came on the air, is president, is that your title, with the National Association of Letter Carriers, Branch 82?
Yeah.
Those who deliver your mail and thank them for it. Elsie, so we're talking about Tim Nesbitt. We got interrupted.
Yeah, Tim Nesbitt is great. But if the labor movement had to live and die with just one person, we would have been dead a long time ago. It's about solidarity and taking the work a little bit further. We've also got to have very good, focused analysis, both strategically and tactically. And those things aren't all the same.
But that analysis, I think, to some extent, comes in, whereas where you come in, you're active on the resolutions committee, right?
That's what's happening right now.
That's fine. But the resolutions committee is sort of where the policy is made at the convention for the AFL-CIO. Tell us, what are some of the most interesting resolutions you guys are working on?
Well, first, Don, let me make it clear that there are a number of different committees, and they deal with different issues. So resolutions, laws and legislation, constitution and bylaws, the committees of the body go off and talk about these ideas that have been brought forth by smaller parts of the federation. So
certainly,
one particular union will send forth a resolution saying, we need to get out of Iraq right now. And in fact, right now we're dealing with five different versions of get out of Iraq right now, or support our troops, or putting the labor movement on record as being in favor of versions of peace. So the structure is that smaller bodies or labor councils or unions send forth ideas for adoption by the body as a whole. The committees go and take a look at it and recommend concurrence or non-concurrence. And that's what we're doing right now, late into the evening.
So, and one of those, and I'm sure one of the more interesting ones with all these proposals, is going to be some statement that the Oregon AFL-CIO is going to say that they're against war. Do you think that's likely to get passed at the convention?
The national AFL-CIO has already gone on record nationally just a couple weeks ago as calling for the rapid withdrawal of our troops.
And what do you make of that? I mean, is that, I hadn't, you know, I was aware of that as a reporter, but I haven't seen extensive attention to it. I mean, is this significant? I mean, back in the Vietnam era, it seemed like, you know, whether labor was going to take a stand or not was a very big deal.
Many people here have very long memories. I'm surrounded by people who are much, much more senior than I, and they remember those days, and they have gotten up and talked quite eloquently about the way that the AFL-CIO and the organized labor movement can make the wrong decision in times of crisis. And I believe there's a motion here, a feeling here, that most folks want to have working Americans not be over in Iraq getting killed, and that we want to bring those people back, particularly folks like our Oregon National Guard need to come back.
You know, can you say anything about, I mean, there's probably a moral, angle that, basically you want to be on record as being opposed to this immoral thing. And I'm sure for anti-war activists, too, this is going to be bringing great comfort. But, will the Oregon AFL-CIO be doing anything concrete as a result of these? Sorry, you're breaking up just a little bit there, the unreliable cell phone company. Maybe it's a non-union company.
Yeah, there's a, well, it depends. Okay. Labor unions represent working people. And to the extent that we define peace as an issue for working people, then yes, the voices of the working people, that is the unions that represent them, can do huge, huge numbers of things to affect the direction that the country is going. But I'm just one person, so I can't tell you what the whole labor movement would do, but I can tell you there's a lot of energy here, a lot of different ideas bubbling up on what we can do as representatives of real working Americans to move towards peace.
Thank you. What are some of the other resolutions that, have your interest?
There's one about fusion voting and trying to get a working party, a working people's party, kind of a third party system, that, and this concept of fusion voting. I know you've had it on your show already with CWA. It looks like that's going to get out of committee and head to the floor tomorrow. There's some stuff about ways to an organizing campaign for the entire state, the actual tactics planned for the state Fed. There's some stuff about union musicians and different individual issues for different locals. There was a big fight over declaring that Ted Kulongowski would be anti-labor, and I think that will be fought out tomorrow with the felt like the majority was pro-labor, but some people have individual ideas about that. It's a very open forum.
Right, so basically activists in their unions get to come up with some of these resolutions and try and make it the official policy if they can find a majority of support. Elsie, I know we're calling you out of your meeting. I appreciate you joined us this evening. And anything else you'd like to add?
The AFL-CIO by November 15th.
Okay. Incomplete thought. Maybe I'll try and, looks like we may have lost her again, these tricky cell phones. Maybe I'll complete that thought because, in fact, the deadline has been extended. There's negotiations going on between the group of unions called Change to Win that split and left the AFL-CIO versus those that stayed. The two sides are negotiating to see if maybe they can stay affiliated at the state and local level, even if they decided that working together at the national level isn't necessary.
That's right, Don. Then that's what I was referring to when I said that it looked really positive and people were going to try to find ways to continue working together, knowing that there's strength in numbers.
So I think we can assume that Elsie Hansen, who's a KBU pioneer and also labor union activist, would also support that. I understand we also have Joe Keir holding on the line, waiting to join us. Joe, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Don.
Joe,
how are you doing?
Joe, I'm doing great. Thanks for coming in. Are you also in a committee meeting that we're keeping?
Yes, I'm in the same resolutions committee as LC, so
okay.
I probably should get back soon.
Okay, well, let me ask it then. I have a few questions, but maybe we'll just start. What's the highlight for you? What's got your passion most engaged in this convention?
Actually, what people just left the convention a couple hours ago to do, which was to go canvassing for Working America, which is the community-based affiliate of the AFL-CIO, whereby people who are not union members can affiliate with the AFL-CIO and be part of the union movement and actually get information about important issues to working people and how votes in Congress are affecting their lives.
Right, and in fact, they just passed, at the national level, they just recently passed the 1 million member mark. And in Oregon, I think they have over 60,000.
Actually, we heard 22,000.
Oh, forgive me.
Oregon.
Okay.
And, but that was a very large number for the size of the state. And in fact, at the national convention for the AFL, our Portland Working America volunteers were up on the stage as the poster children for the success of this movement.
And by the way, you know, for listeners who are interested in this, you don't have to wait till the canvasser knocks on your door. You can go online and find out about it and join up. I believe it's workingamerica.org, but undoubtedly you could Google and find that. Working America, it's basically an affiliate, like Joe said, for, you know, working people, most of us, who may not have a union in their workplace but do want to be involved and engaged and hear about issues that come up as working people.
It's a great way for people to be involved in issues. And tonight people were out canvassing talking about the Bush administration repealed the Davis-Bacon provisions in the hurricane relief work and the rebuilding work in the Gulf Coast, and how that's something that needs to be challenged in Congress. And so they're asking members of Working America to contact their senators here in Oregon and tell them to vote to repeal what Bush has done.
So you missed out on the canvas of Working America because you were on the Resolutions Committee, and now you're missing out on the Resolutions Committee because you're a guest on Labor Radio. I appreciate it. You know, one of the resolutions I wonder what you think about is was just mentioned, the Working Families Party resolution, a very interesting idea, you know, the idea that labor would maybe form its own party and operate with this thing called fusion voting. We had talk about it actually last week on this show. What's your view about that?
Well, my personal view is I think that the way to get real electoral reform is to support something like the instant runoff voting, which is something that the city of Vancouver has already passed, whereby a third party actually has a chance to run in an election and have their votes count toward one of the major parties if they don't make it. And so no one's accused of wasting a vote that way. So I think in terms of electoral reform, that's probably the best option we have in front of us.
So that's your opinion. And Joe, by the way, I didn't properly identify. Joe, in addition to being a KABU listener and supporter, undoubtedly, is also a delegate from the International Association of Machinists, District Lodge 24, am I right?
Right. I'm a delegate from Local 1005.
Local 1005, which is the group of workers that work at Freightliner, manufacturing trucks, have a very strong union.
And several other shops around town, including Silver Eagle Manufacturing.
So what's the machinist position on the Working Families Party, if they have one?
The machinist is opposed to the idea, thinking that we should be involved in supporting the Democratic Party and their existing electoral process for the time being. It's not that we're opposed to the idea of a Labor Party at some point down the road, but that for the immediate future, especially in the year 2006, we need to concentrate on getting a Democratic Congress elected, and that's where efforts should be.
So that's the union position. Now, do individual delegates at a convention like this get to vote their own conscience, or are they required to vote for the union point?
We're typical of many of the union delegations in that we have a discussion beforehand, and we talk about what the issues mean for our members and generally come to a consensus.
So to some extent, then, you guys vote as a block, but with a kind of a collective conscience after whatever discussion has been.
Right.
So you might end up being a minority within your union. You vote according to the union's wishes. Now, at AFSCME, which...
people feel that they're really committed to an issue, they will vote along their personal beliefs, but mostly we have a consensus that's developed.
So any other thoughts, then, about resolutions or maybe about this split, which I'm sure, you know, machinists, by the way, of course, obviously being a union that stayed in the AFL-CIO, otherwise you wouldn't be at the convention. Joe, thoughts on that?
Well, I do have thoughts on it in that, you know, democracy is really important for the union movement, and the unions that left refused to participate in the democratic process at the AFL National Convention. If they had stayed, they could have participated and raised their ideas and let the delegates vote at that. But they refused to actually participate in the debate, and they just left. I think that the AFL-CIO on the Oregon level is showing how democracy works, and hopefully people will be able to affiliate, even if they're not members of AFL-CIO unions at the national level. This deal is completed by November 15th. We may be able to have unions locally reaffiliate and try to rebuild our united efforts in Oregon.
Yeah, in fact, that was something today. Joe, you were there, undoubtedly. John Sweeney, the president of the National AFL-CIO, gave a little address to today's convention in Oregon, and he said that that's basically that they're sort of optimistic at this point that they're going to reach an agreement to allow these unions to stay in at the local level.
Yes, because they're they're getting closer in terms of what it would cost for an affiliation of the actually for the local affiliation. Because it's not just a matter of paying the regular per capita fees, which the local affiliates would have to do, but also make up for the fact that the AFL-CIO locally would not be supported by their union membership nationally. So there's an additional cost that is being worked out.
Right. Well, Joe, I want to thank you for taking time out of your committee meeting and for joining us this evening on Labor Radio.
Okay, thanks for the good work.
We've been talking with Joe Keir, a delegate to today's Oregon AFL-CIO convention from the International Association of Machinists, I believe, and Aerospace Workers. They may have even a few other groups in there. It's a long name, a historic union, District Council 24. We may try and get on the line also Madeline Elder, who is a former host of this program and also is the president of the Communications Workers of America 7901. We may or may not be able to reach her, but in the meantime, we're lucky to have with us Mary Orr, once again, delegate from AFSCME Local 88. So, Mary, we were interrupted. I know that you had another point that just before we left that you wanted to make.
I have a few, but I would like to make one because we've been talking about elections and electoral politics quite a bit. And that's that Bradbury was speaking today.
It's Bill Bradbury,
Bill Bradbury,
Secretary of State of Oregon.
Correct. And he asked a question I want to ask you, and that is, do you have your passport or birth certificate on you at the moment?
No, neither of those.
And do you have those readily available at home?
I'm sure I could find them within a few minutes.
Within a few minutes, okay. Well, a lot of people can't. A lot of people can't. Yeah, that's the wrong answer there, Don. And he talked about something that's very important for us to oppose, and that's ID, requirements for citizenship ID before voting. And statistics show that seniors, people over 65, often don't have that readily available. Sometimes they never had it. Also, African Americans are less likely to have ID such as passports. If you were to have a certain kind of federal ID that they're thinking about being a requirement to vote, it would require many forms. These also cost a lot of money. They don't come free. And I think we have to really watch out for this because this is about voter accessibility, and it's about silencing the voice of so many people, especially the poor, and to disenfranchise them even further. So
Bill Bradbury, of course, is a Democrat. He's opposed to this, it was, in the speech today. I mean, who is pushing this proposal and at what level? He didn't explain. But it's certainly something to be opposed then. Restrictions on people's voting. I didn't know that there was a big scandal that I've heard of where you have foreign citizens trying to vote in U.S. elections. Maybe they should, in fact, because the U.S. president seems to, kind of run the world a little bit. Too much, maybe. So, okay, yeah, so that was one thought, uncompleted. We were talking a little bit about the mood, about the split, about Tim Nesbitt. Do you want to say anything about the working families? And I know I wanted to mention, your union, AFSCME, is a little bit unusual in that, well, by a lot of ways, right? You're shrugging your shoulders. A little bit unusual in that your local units get to vote whatever they want rather than the international union, voting as a bloc. Is that right?
Are you talking about at this convention?
Convention, right. But
yes.
Most unions, again, to explain a little bit, I mean, they have this international body, and then they charter local bodies called locals. And then typically at a state convention, you'd have all the locals of a particular international, say, for example, machinists or steelworkers or stuff like that, would end up voting as a bloc together. But you guys, for better or worse, sometimes split your vote in that maybe this local doesn't agree with that local and so forth.
That's correct. And so in other words, we have the OHSU, we have the city, we have Multnomah County.
DEQ.
Pardon me?
DEQ.
Correct, DEQ, exactly.
It's a quarter of this program, I just wanted to mention.
Oh, thanks. Anyway, we could all vote differently, and within our ranks, we would make a decision. Sometimes that would be a vote by our membership. Do we vote all one way and have one person, such as the president, carry all the votes, or do we all vote our conscience? And mostly we do it the way that Joe here just described, where we talk about it and try to reach consensus, because that's the healthiest way to do that. In addition, we do have some caucuses where all of the locals will come together and will talk about the issues and try to reach consensus there as well.
I saw you guys caucusing, in fact, today. What was the secret you guys were talking about?
Well, if it's a secret, how could I tell you? No, we were discussing some of the measures coming up, especially exploring the formation of a party for working people in Oregon, and how we need to make clear that what that resolution is looking at exploring. It's not saying we're going to do it. And so we were talking about that, and also the difficulty in explaining fusion voting and so on, to make sure that people, it's a big education and training issue.
It is. Should we start now with maybe 30 seconds, or are you off the hook? I mean, I'll go ahead and make a stab at it, actually. Fusion voting is something that used to be on the books almost everywhere in the country. We talked about this last week a little bit, so I'll make it quick. But, you know, apparently the two major parties conspired, they controlled the legislature, and they passed laws outlawing it. The way it works, still works, by the way, in New York State, and
theoretically
in a couple other places, this sort of works maybe. But the idea is that any party can endorse whoever they want. So you might have the two major party candidates, available, but there's a third or fourth or fifth party. They get to endorse maybe the Democrat or the Republican, whichever candidate most expresses their point of view. Maybe they're libertarians and they tend to like the Republicans the most, but they could endorse a Democrat. Maybe they're a working families party. They tend to like Democrats the most, but they could go the other way or run their own candidate. That's the idea. It's a little bit more free and open system, but a way which, a small party, a minor party, a third party could achieve some influence. So that's something that the Oregon labor movement is now apparently considering pursuing for Oregon.
That's correct. And some people feel like, no, we should not do that. We need to just stick with what we have, or we're going to end up with nothing. But others are saying, when is the time to change? There's never a time to change. It's never a good time. And so we're going to have to plunge in, at least explore this.
Mary, we will have time for one or two more questions, but I want to interrupt you once again, because we do finally, we have Madeline Elder joining us. Madeline, welcome to Labor Radio.
Hi there.
Or should I say welcome back? Madeline is actually the person who recruited me as a host. I'm a reporter for a labor union newspaper, and Madeline is, of course, the head of the local 7901 of CWA, Communication Thanks. Workers. Madeline, are you coming out of a meeting as well, or do we have you for a minute?
Yes.
Okay.
I just came out of the resolutions committee meeting.
Yeah, and you're a person with strong opinions, Madeline. What resolutions are exciting you at this point?
Well, the resolution on Iraq, the resolution on the Working Families Party, which my local sponsors, and there was one that excited me, and that was to use union labor when you're doing musicians and actors and theatricals and all that. There were a lot of things. Last week we talked a whole lot, long time about the Working Families Party, and I'm sure other callers have talked about, the AFL-CIO's position on Iraq. But I have to say, this gets back to kind of the basics. It's like, all these people are trying to make excuses why they needed to hire people who weren't professional musicians who weren't members of the musicians to sing or play at one of their union-sponsored events. And it was like, but that's not, that displaces union workers.
Right, and that's something I think within the union movement, there's been a real strong push over the years on this sort of a principled thing that they want to use union-supplied services and products.
Exactly.
Right.
I was kind of shocked at how people were like kind of backpedaling on that. Well, what if we do this or what if we do that? It's like, dude.
And that's particularly important. That idea is important to your union, because one of the parts of your union represents the print shops, the union print shops, and a lot of the business that they end up getting is from union-influenced enterprises,
right,
or enterprises where that union label actually matters anymore. Like for some Democratic politicians, to have the union label on your materials, I guess, still means something, that they want to demonstrate a point of view.
I agree. And the other thing that I think is, I'm sitting here with a campaign for Singular and a campaign trying to organize Verizon Wireless. Singular has a neutrality agreement. They encourage union representation. We have some really good contracts with them nationwide and so on. Verizon Wireless fights us every step of the way. We've only been able to organize 50 people in the entire United States who work for Verizon Wireless, and we have to do a nationwide campaign just to get their contract.
Right, that's good to get the word out, in fact.
But I have unions who say, well, I'd rather go with Verizon Wireless because, they have better coverage. Well, excuse me, but you're funding their anti-union campaigns by buying their products. And it's the same thing with not going with union musicians and so on.
Madeline, unfortunately, we're out of time for this hour. We'd like to go the next hour, but it's really terrific to have you back on the air. As some long-term listeners may remember, Madeline Elder, host of Labor Radio, coming back as a guest. Thanks, Madeline.
Thank you very much.
We have just a few seconds left, obviously, Mary, but I know you wanted to tell us about a meeting that you had with some French workers.
Actually, I just got back from vacation in France where I would ask people who helped me out with directions if they were union members, and if they were, I gave them a union pin from my local. And at first, my French isn't very good, and at first they thought I was going to say something negative about unions. They'd start to explain the
because
importance
you're an American,
of them.
Or, you're Canadian.
Right, but the same thing, details, more or less, yes, North American. And they were pleasantly surprised to realize they were talking with a fellow traveler and were very excited, and to the extent that even the airline clerk at Lufthansa put on the union pin and said, you know, our country's going the same way as the States. It's a global problem. We need a revolution. That's what this man said to me. We need a revolution. Another man in France said, the working people will rise again. It's a bad time right now. They talked quite a bit about Bush. They could not understand how workers here and the unemployed, anyone, did not have health care. How could we not have universal health care in this country, this rich country? And that's something that was touched on today at the convention as well. A cornerstone to workers' rights and workers' conditions and to keep us from falling back is to make sure that we have health care.
If you don't have health, your health, what else do you have? It was so, in a way, discouraging to see that we don't have the strength of labor movement that they do have in most of our peers in the industrialized world like Europe. But it's also, on the other hand, encouraging sometimes and exciting to meet these folks. I remember a few years back at the WTO demonstrations in Seattle coming across a group of French workers, and they were so spirited. You know, they really have a lot to teach us, I think, about how to make a labor movement. So you met some of those in your recent vacation, and it sort of inspires you to come back and to stay involved as a union activist. You know, any last thoughts then about the convention? It's going on today. It's going on tomorrow. Sounds like we're going to have an anti-war resolution come out of the Oregon AFL-CIO and maybe Working Families Party.
I believe that that's true. Yes. Yep.
And your union will be supporting both of those.
I believe that's true as well. Yes, indeed.
Any other thoughts then? We just have maybe a second or two.
A convention. I encourage everyone to attend. You can attend it as observer, even if you're not a delegate or an alternate, because this is what sets the tone, the goals, the strategy. It's what we stand for. You can watch.
I didn't know you could attend this as an observer. I saw a number of observers today. There was a number of press there, actually. And just to mention, I mean, we had, Governor Ted Kulongoski was there, Congressman Peter DeFazio, Congressman Earl Blumenauer was there, each of them giving talks. You had Secretary of State Bill Bradbury, and you had Dan Gardner, the labor commissioner.
That's
big,
correct.
Big labor guy. And Randy Leonard, of course, welcoming them to Portland. He's an old labor guy himself, city commissioner of Portland. Tomorrow they actually have some pretty good speakers in the morning too. Actually, Stuart Acuff, who is an old Oregon union guy, went to work for the National AFL-CIO, and he's just a really riveting speaker on the issue of industrial policy, about how this country doesn't have an industrial policy. Instead, its policy is to have no policy, which is to let the corporations do whatever they want, and it ends up a lot of us lose jobs in this country because of that. So he's going to be speaking tomorrow morning. I'm not sure just what time. If you do want to come down and see this strange, interesting union democracy at work, check out the Oregon AFL-CIO's website. That's orafl-cio.org. I know that they do have a schedule on there that you can click on, and if you have internet access.
If you're concerned that 99% of Americans took a pay cut last year, then please join us.
Mary, I want to really thank you again for joining us tonight on Labor Radio. We've been talking with Mary Orr, who is a delegate from AFSCME to the Oregon AFL convention underway today and tomorrow. You've been listening to Labor Radio. I want to thank you for joining us tonight and every week. Tune in next week for Labor Radio. We'll be back actually with a talk about privatization with host Kevin Card. I want to thank also our engineer, Ben Levine, for managing a chaotic evening full of phone calls and fun. And stay tuned for Time Sound, a program of soul music with host Kevin Baring.